I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello, here we are at episode 198. How are you? We have something very different in store for you today. But before I tell you about it, a big shout out to our Patreon supporters, without whom we would not be able to produce this podcast. Because we're wholly self-funded with no advertisers. So if you hear what you like, go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile, click on the Linktree drop-down box, and you can follow a link to their Patreon page, where you can give a little support from as little as £3 a month, which is pretty much a cup of coffee. And you can rest assured that 100% of your money goes back into this podcast. Well, I know I've mentioned it before, and I'm bound to mention it again, but Kursler Art's exhibition called Freedom, curated by Ai Weiwei, is still on at the Royal Festival Hall. It's a very powerful and moving exhibition. And without Kursler Arts, I wouldn't be here today. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, you decide. But anyway, to this week's episode. As I mentioned earlier, today's guest is something a little bit different. He's not a visual artist, he's a writer. But what he creates does end up on our screens. He's written Gone to the Dogs, Births, Marriages and Deaths, that was with Ray Winston. More notably, Our Girl with Michelle Keegan. Well, I met Tony some time ago at Ray Richardson's studio. I literally got introduced to Tony in passing. As I was leaving Ray's studio, Tony was entering it. But I knew of Tony and we got chatting on social media a little while after and thought it would be great to have him on as a guest. So I asked him to come on and, well, here we are today. So please, come with me as I spoke over Zoom to writer Tony Grounds.
Yes, so I live in Buswell Hill.
Nice.
But I was born in Ilford. Yeah, moved out to Billericay. So that's where...
Is that the Lee Evans connection? Or did you just... Was that part of the industry?
No, I mean, obviously there is a connection. I went to the Mayflower company, went to Billericay comp across the other side of the divide, as it were. He was on the posh side of the railway.
Well, Tony, I have 7 questions I ask each guest. Okay. First being, how would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
Well, I'd say I was a dramatist, working predominantly in television. I'm a writer, but if you say you're a writer, people go, oh, you must be really clever.
I
go, oh.
I can buck that trend.
So, you know, like a dramatist is a sort of like a but then people still say, what do you do all the words as well? I go, well, yeah, that's kind of, and what they're doing yeah, you know, like, so I think people don't quite understand, you know, you just, I start with a blank piece of paper and I have to fill it up, you know, and I have to give, you know, 60 minutes if it's a BBC show, 60 minutes of that's going to keep the audience entertained. You know, you're not doing a diary, so you can't just do it for yourself. It's not a diary that goes under your bed. Yeah. You're writing something that millions and millions of people are going to see.
Yeah. Not and much pressure then, eh?
Critic. Well, yeah, everyone's a bloody critic, aren't they? Yeah.
So. And how does that equate into pages, Tony? An hour's bit of dialogue?
So roughly it's a minute a page. So an hour on TV. Obviously, it's written out as a...
Of course, script. Yeah.
So 60 pages. You try to keep it under 60 pages. Because, wow. Of course, you know, if you're doing 70 pages and you think, well, I'll cut it down in the edit, it's a lot of money. You know, you're adding another 15% to the budget because that's the number of days and the number of shots. So production companies like to get it pretty much on time now.
So does that stop any leeway, does it, or... Are you all right to edit afterwards?
Yeah, so you obviously, once you go into once you've filmed it, or you go into the edit, and that's when you have to get it down to, if it's BBC, you know, 59 minutes 30 seconds. An ITV show now is about 45 minutes, I think. So that's an ITV hour, you know. So, and some of the other ones even less. So if you're doing an hour, you know, you might have an hour and 10 minutes in the first cut, and then you'll try to sort of, you have to get that down to time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the streamers now are changing that because, you know, nobody tells Netflix or Amazon or Apple if they want to do a 2 hour, 15 minute episode, they can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas how have you seen that change in the industry, Tony?
Well, you know, it's, one of the big changes is there's now so many independent companies. So I think there was like, when I started off, I think the BBC just used to make all their own programmes, and they'd have all their departments, you know, camera department, they'd be training directors, wig makers, everything. So the BBC was this sort of thing. And then they decided that, oh no, it's got to be 50% with independent companies. Yeah. So some of the independent companies were springing up, and then it went to 0%. So everybody is an independent company. Even what they call, you know, BBC in-house now is BBC Studios, but it's a separate company now from BBC.
Wow, I didn't know.
So everything is made outside. So when they were made, when I was sort of first starting off, there was maybe a dozen independent companies, you know, the old ones like Tiger Aspect, or
you
know, like and those ones. And I think that the BBC are now working with 800.
Wow.
So, you know, everybody's like so setting up their own companies. You know, there was a time when it, you know, it was like hugely lucrative. They get two or three hits and suddenly people are buying their companies for, you know, 40, 50, 60 million.
Well, you mentioned that you was born and brought up in Ilford in Essex.
Yeah, well, I was born in Ilford, then we moved to Billericay,
Well, how does someone like that become involved in writing? How did that journey start?
Yeah, I mean, that is like, that's obviously weird because I'm probably the only writer that's come out of Mayflower Comprehensive. I mean, and you know, all I did at school was hide most of the time. I would like lock myself in the loo. So it was like quite rough in those days. Rookie is a bit better now, isn't it? And I think Mayflower is better now. But it was I suppose it was just like what you'd call your bog standard comprehensive in those days, when it was just on comprehensive. So they were all secondary moderns, really, that you know, they just changed the name on the door, hadn't they? So I don't know. I was working in the Crown in Billericay High Street, the pub.
Oh yeah.
Somebody came into the pub one day and they offered me another job up in Tower Hill, which was like on the exchanges there. So then I saw there was an advert for the Old Vic Youth Theatre, because I was still a teenager, you know, like I was like 17, 18. And I'd always sort of thought, oh, it's drama something that I quite liked doing drama at school. And then we had to like a nice, an interesting drama teacher, but he got long hair. So my dad went, "Wait, he's a
brilliant,
he's a dodgy fucker, if ever." Yeah. And he was the teacher that said, "Oh, call me Reg." And my dad was going, "Call me Reg, call me Reg." You know, like, so he didn't get it at all.
Yeah.
He said, "There's something weird about that." And then, of course, we go back after the school holidays, and Reg had become Ruth, and my dad was sick.
Oh, wow.
I know. And back then,
of course, it was very strange.
My dad was going, "I've got the Billericay recorder here. Look, that Reg, I told you, no bloody good. He's now Ruth." I mean, actually, yeah, I just wish I never saw him or her, you know, never saw Ruth then from then on. But, you know, I would have loved to have, because maybe that was probably their sort of the start of that interest in
drama.
So then I went to the Old Vic Youth Theatre, and I just walked into that room, and it was the big green room upstairs, and there was a whole collection of different people, and, you know, we started doing improvisations and stuff like that, and I thought, for the first time in my life, my plug fits here.
Nice.
I kind of get it, you know.
You said you went to the Old Vic. Was that the first time you'd gone into an environment like that?
Yeah.
And if so, what led you to there? Was it just your teacher?
Yeah, well, not even my teacher. It's just something I was just thinking, you know, and I started to, take an interest in like on the telly, you know, I'd be watching like the Mike Lee, you know, like, so the Nuts in May and Abigail's Party and, you know, those Boys from the Black stuff. And you're going, "Oh, bloody hell, you know, this is you know, I can sit." And so I went there, and there was a whole mix of people. By this time, I was living in Camberwell on a council estate on Comber Grove.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought, this is great. And then we started doing these improvisations. And so I started to sort of be the gobby one during the improvisation. You know, like, we did the first play. And like, and as soon as I, you know, said just like upstairs. And as soon as I said a few lines, I was everybody looking at me like going...
Mate, there's got to be one from
the writing, because you're like fucking shit at the act. But that was how it first came about, really. So they called in a writer called Owen Weimark, and she was going to write about, you know, all our experiences. And there was lots of kids from the estates, and lots of kids that were getting into like bad trouble. And there was a whole mix as well. There was other kids, so it was quite a sort of, you know, an interesting sort of fusion of London, really.
Yeah.
But predominantly from the local area and from the estates, you know. So she was working with us writing these plays. And in the end, she was saying, "Well, would you know, you basically, you know," so I was telling her a different story. She said, "Well, just write that. We'll put that in. I don't need to change anything." So then I'm thinking, right, like my play, or, you know, part thereof, is going on at the Old Vic. You know, I'd never been to the theatre. The first time I've been to see my stuff on there.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it was the youth theatre, but they gave us the main stage. And in those days, theatres allowed youth theatres to come in and experiment.
Yeah.
Not like now, you know. So I did that for a few years, and then they moved to the Lyric Hammersmith. I think the Old Vic was being refurbed or something. We moved to the Lyric Hammersmith, and the lady was running it, a lady called Lucy Park, said, "Will you write the next play completely on your own?" So no others. No.
Shit.
Yeah. So then I'd written this play going on at the Lyric Hammersmith. And then my friend said, "Go to..."
And that went into production, Tony, did it?
Yeah, but I mean, it was the youth theatre again. But, yeah.
It had an audience and a cast, and it was a play that you'd written. Amazing. Yeah. Can you remember what it was?
Yeah, it was called Get Out. I'll tell you what. Is that the one? Oh, no. I did have the bloody sign for it. I've obviously lost it now. Get Out of That then, you know. So then I went to drama school, and then they said, "Oh, we're going to do a festival at the Lyric in Hammersmith. So do you want to write a play for the studio there?" So I thought, yeah, okay. So I wrote this play. So it was under this festival, like, of a youth theatre, because by this time I'm in my early 20s. Yeah, the youth theatre was like what they called, I suppose it was like about 14, 15, up to about 25, 26, so it's like young people, I suppose, more. And then I wrote this play called Made in Spain, that they put on there. Then that won the Verity Bargate Award.
Wow.
And then they said, we're going to put this on telly.
Shit.
So it's, you know, like, although that's a few years, I've concertinaed a few years.
Yeah, of course.
That's easy. But yeah, so I thought, oh, bloody hell, that's going on the telly.
Wow.
That was just the most exciting thing. I thought, I can see my name on the telly. And I never thought that would ever happen. Like, yeah. This is all apropos of your first question. Suddenly, you know, my name's on the telly and I've written this play.
And in that short time, how did it feel from being in this relatively new creative world,
yeah,
to winning an award and then it being on the telly?
Yeah. So it was a few years.
Yeah.
Probably, I don't know, like, you know, 6 or 7 years. So it felt like it was a long struggle.
Yeah.
But now, of course, when you look back, oh yeah, piece of piss. But of course. It wasn't, you know, like, so I don't know. It felt like, you know, I was on the verge of this strange, I didn't know whether I'd ever write anything else again. And in those days, people watched telly live. So when that went on, the next day, I'd got an agent as well. And EastEnders rung up, said, did you want to do 2 episodes of EastEnders? And The Bill rung up. Did I want to do a couple of episodes of The Bill?
Brilliant.
So I did that. So suddenly I'm doing those. You know, I go in to see the EastEnders people and they go, are you a fan of EastEnders? I've never watched an episode. So I went, God, yes.
You love it.
Love it, love it. They said, fantastic. Oh, you're just exactly what we want. So come into the writers' meeting. And so they do this writers' meeting where all the writers of what they're going to write the episodes. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing, obviously, you know. And so I go into this room and there's all the writers there. Lots have done, you know, like loads of episodes and stuff. And then the script editor, I don't know who all these people were, you know, but they all, you know, it was quite intimidating for me. And then they said, all the rights, right, episode, you know, 312 is the explosion in the cafe. And so it's, you know, episode 213 is, you know, like Pauline gets raped and dragged and buried in a shallow grave, but then she's all right. So they go through all these storylines and I'm like thinking, what? And I could see everybody else, and it gets to the end, and then all the writers go, I'll do 312, I'll do 330.
Oh, wow.
They've listened out for all the big, you know, they were taking all the, and I'm the only one left in the room. They go, Tone, you've got Dot loses her slippers. Good luck with that. So I did those two episodes, which were the first episodes that Phil and whatever it was, the Mitchell brothers came into.
Yeah.
So, you know, but you're sort of kind of told, it's quite prescriptive. You're told what to do there. And then I got
on the CV, Tony, you could have been anyone, could have written anything, couldn't you? Because you was on EastEnders. That's it.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. But then people still go, like, I did those tours of EastEnders, didn't have a bloody clue what I was doing, scribbled them down, you know.
And did you have to blag it or did you just sit there quietly and politely and waiting to see how it went?
No, I completely blagged it. I handed it in and they were going, oh, yeah, but do you remember like Dot's doing Panto this week or whatever it is? You know, so they moved everything around. I didn't have a clue what was going on. And you go and watch one day's film and you're sitting in a sort of box and you're looking at it on the monitor. And I didn't know anything. I just thought, I've just got to get out of here because otherwise I'm going to be banged up for fraud here. You know, you know, I've got my money, so yeah. I'm going to go, you know. And it was a bit the same on The Bill. And then I did an episode or two on Chancer, you know, which was the Clive Owens first thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I still thought, oh, I can't do this. But what I hadn't sussed out was that writing, you know, to other people's, you know, order and characters wasn't my bag. Yeah. I was like, no, good. Other people could do that much better. In those days, ITV was divided up into all the regions. So although they were nationwide coverage, but like Central TV or Granada.
Meridian, yeah.
Yeah, they'd all have their own sort of slots. So this was Central TV. And I'm walking on the corridor and there's Ted Childs, who was running Central Television drama. And he said, have you got any other ideas or anything? So I said, well, yeah, I want to write a drama about greyhound racing because I've been going off to Walthamstow.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I love greyhound racing. Can you do six episodes?
Ka-ching.
I know. So it's just like by chance. So I went, yeah, six. in easy, Ted. And he said, by October. Yeah, yeah, October. I'm thinking, you know. But, of course, now I'm suddenly able to be a writer because, I suppose it's, you know, I can now invent all my own characters.
It was a bona fide commission, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like, oh, that's what I'm good at.
Yeah,
inventing brilliant. My own worlds,
yeah,
not filling in for. So it's the difference, but you know, if you're a painter, like sitting outside Leicester Square doing people's caricatures, and something you can, like, no, you can go and paint whatever you want.
Yeah,
is your canvas? Get on with it.
And how was that bit of freedom? Did it come with pressure or?
Well,
or not?
There's a certain amount of pressure, but it's also incredibly liberating. Weirdly. Yeah. And they said, who do you see in it? So I just like named my heroes. So I said, oh, well, Jim Broadbent, who I'd seen in a play. I love Jim Broadbent.
Brilliant.
Still do. Alison Steadman.
Yeah.
So she was in it. She's still my best mate and lives up the road.
Excellent.
And we're neighbours. So we go to the pub together.
Nice.
Yeah, she's oh, shall I have a, I'll have a little gin and tonic.
Yeah. 10 later.
Exactly. So Warren Clark was in it, Harry Enfield. We did this first series, and it seemed to go down a storm. People still talk about that show, which is
that was a series of six, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was six. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then I'm up and running, so I've had my own series on now.
Yeah.
So now I'm a creator rather than just doing the dot to dot on EastEnders.
Yeah.
It was. Felt really good, and you know, and suddenly, you know, Gone to the Dogs is going up for awards and stuff like that, and I'm thinking, oh, maybe I am a writer, you know, I still feel a bit, even now, as an old fella, and I've done, like, you know, 50 things, I still, when people say, what do? You're still, I feel a little bit of embarrassment, I'm a writer. Right, but don't judge.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not sure how I got here, but I am a writer.
Yeah. Well, it's like I don't know. It's, I don't know why. I don't know how people write and create, really. And if we did, you know, we'd all know what the secret formula is.
Yeah,
you've just got to come up with an idea, I suppose. And it's quite interesting that first thing I said to Ted was, "Oh, I've got this idea about greyhound racing, where this rogue gets a bloody three-legged greyhound and he's gonna take it into some classy kennels and get it inseminated so he can breed off of it."
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Plan, you know.
And is that the one that had the West Ham guys in it?
Yeah, Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst,
brilliant.
Pacers.
Now I'm well aware that you're a huge West Ham fan.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm presuming that was just because you could.
Yeah, and the producer said to me, one of the characters has got this big world. You can see how long ago it was. He just opened the video warehouse, you know,
yeah.
Like.
Oh well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he needed somebody to come and open it, and she said, Who would you like to come and open it? So I said, well, let's have Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst and Martin Peters.
The World Cup trio.
And Donna Ewing, who was the page three bird.
I like your thinking, Tony.
So she came in the next day. She said, yeah, I booked them all. So when I met her, you know, meeting Bobby Moore was like absolutely fantastic. Because my earliest memory was standing on the chicken run with my dad.
Yeah.
And Bobby Moore coming over to take a throw in. And my dad going, that is Bobby Moore. I want you to never forget this moment.
Brilliant.
And of course you don't, because he's told you to never forget it, you know,
yeah.
The number six. And there's Bobby Moore. I told Bobby Moore, and he was such a sort of modest guy, because they weren't the footballers then, once they'd retired, weren't like the footballers now, I don't think. You know,
no.
They were ordinary guys, I think.
Got a pub, yeah, if they were lucky.
Yeah, I think he got a sports shop at, you know, Bobby Moore's or something. And Hurst and Peters were working in insurance. They were selling insurance.
It's mad to think that, Tony, isn't it?
Incredible. I said, oh, look, you know, like, there's going to be a wedding later on, but maybe you could have got friendly with them and come to the wedding scenes. He said, yeah, I'd love that. So actually, Bobby Moore ended up doing about a week on it. And so I got
Brilliant.
Quite friendly with him.
Excellent.
So that was, you know, that was amazing times.
And then after that was Gone to Seed, is that correct?
Yeah, so that was like a follow-on.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that was probably bad mistake one, because they said, do you want to do another series of Gone to the Dogs? And I thought, no, I'm going to do something new, you know, like,
yeah.
Now
I've got a good idea.
I know, yeah, the holy grail is to get a returning series.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I said, oh, I'll do something like it. We'll do the Gone 2 concept, and so it'll be a wholly new series, you know.
Yeah.
But we'll have you know, Jim and Alison and Warren. And then we got Peter Cook came into that.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it was his last sort of drama. So, but it was great working with him.
And I was just about to say, how was it working with Peter Cook?
No, I mean, he was great. Like a lovely guy and, you know, would come in with his tins of Tennent's Extra. I go, oh, you're drinking today then, Peter? This isn't drinking. This stops me shaking. I'm drinking. So he was like, he was like a vodka man, you know, like in the, but he couldn't sit still. So you go to the pub with him, it would be 5 minutes in one pub. Come on, drink up. And then the next pub, you know.
Brilliant.
He was always on the go, you know.
Yeah. Did you have to adapt much for him? Because I know that he's he was pretty well known for putting in his own words, ad-libbing.
No. I think on a drama, I think on comedies he did that, but on a drama, no, he was like absolutely stuck to the script. I mean, he was finding it. It wasn't easy for him to remember the lines, so he'd always say to me, "Less is more with me." You know.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And Mark Jones was in that with him, so it was like, yeah, it was a nice old cast that.
Comedians are generally quite good in a drama, aren't they?
I think so. I think, well, they can be. I mean, I'm sure it's not all, but, you know, there is something about a comedian that can then turn on the sadness, you know. It's
yeah.
Like the tears of a clown, I think. Yeah, and they are amazing, you know.
Had you developed a name then as a writer after your first?
I guess so, yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, I think people were sort of, yeah. And I think I might have done Our Boy then.
Yeah.
With Ray Winstone, and then Ray's way back in. Ray hadn't worked for like 10 years. You know, he'd done Scum, and then there was this sort of...
He popped up in Minder every now and then, didn't he, as the mechanic?
But I think he'd nutted a director or something. So there was like, it was sort of like he got bad vibes on him.
Yeah.
So I did Our Boy. I just thought, you know, when Ray gets it right, he's absolutely brilliant, you know.
He's amazing, isn't he?
Yeah. But so I did Our Boy with him. And then I did a show called Births, Marriages and Deaths with him, which was a four-parter.
Yeah.
Where he was brilliant. And that was him and Phil Davis and Mark Strong. You know, like in Quadrophenia, what a performance that is.
Yeah.
You know, Ray in Scum, you know, what a performance that is. You know, Steadman in when she did The Singing Detective or Nuts in May, you know, amazing performances. We have had some incredible performances, you know, in this
I mean, Ray Winstone in Scum, that was one of the things that straightened out a lot of young lads, you know, who were going down that dodgy path. Yeah. They watched Scum and they was like, I don't want to be a part of that. Scared straight without even going away the first time.
Yeah. No, it was like shocking. I mean, brilliantly made by a guy called Alan Clark. And then the Alan story,
brilliant.
I mean, Ray tells this story. I don't know how accurate it is or whether it's become a story, you know, an apocryphal story. But Ray tells me he was dropping his mate off at the audition and he walked off down the corridor, like with his swagger.
A bit of swagger, yeah.
And Alan Clark went, who's that? And they went, oh, it's just my mate dropping me off. Get him back in here. That's exactly how the bloke should walk.
Yeah.
So he gets back in there and then he gets the lead part.
Super. As a writer, do you have people in mind for the characters you're creating? Do you associate them with someone you know or...
Well, yeah, sometimes. I think it becomes a sort of an amalgam. So where your ideas come from, they're partly of things from your past, you know, things that you've experienced, and you add a little bit and you've heard other people's stories and, you know, so that character...
Yeah, sort of a little collage, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was interesting with... sorry, a long-winded way to answer your question, really, so when we'd done Our Girl, which was this the show that I've been on for the last few years, and about a girl in the army, you know, like and we're talking about it at some culture event with the exec John York, and they said, "Oh, tell us what it's about, Tony." So I said, "Well, it's about this girl from a dysfunctional and chaotic family from East London who decides to change her life around, break the expected narrative of her life, and joins the army, and then does something successful." And John said to me, "Yeah, because it's Tony's, like, I think it's his most autobiographical piece." And I went, I said, well, he said, no, I mean it. You know, the way you were at, you know, the Mayflower, and you know, nothing was expected of you. Yeah. You know, your careers bloke said, oh, get a job in the shop. You know, that was my careers advice. And you know, I broke the expected narrative of my life and went on to be, you know, a writer and, you know, doing stuff for theatre and television. And so he said, you know, that's what it is. But I hadn't really realised that was autobiographical. Of course, it's not really autobiographical, but it is too, you know, so you get those things.
Well, it's great, the different perspective, like yourself obviously being in the bubble, looking out, but someone else looking in, they see it with completely different eyes, don't they?
Yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah.
And do you see it as autobiographical now?
No, not really. Not really. there are aspects of it. Yeah. And of course, that became such a sort of big thing. You know, we did 5 series of it. Yeah. So in the end, you're just trying to work out other sort of like, oh, what would be good here? Or, you know, like, so it became like this, although it is a sort of army piece about a medic, you know, you need a love life, you need everything else intertwined, because it's like, it was very popular with a sort of younger audience, younger and diverse audience. And so, it was, you're just working out stories that, but when I do like single films, which I've done like, you know, a few of now, all those short run, what they call authored pieces, 3 or 4 parts of like Burst, Marriage and Death, or Bodily Harm, which I did for Channel 4. And that was with Leslie Manville and Tim Spall. That was great. So I don't know, like sometimes I sort of see an ideal person, especially somebody like Jim Broadbent. Sometimes we don't get him, you know, Jim Broadbent. But I remember when I wrote When I'm 64, and I had in mind Jim Broadbent and Ray Winstone. Well, of course, they weren't available when we came to filming it, because it was a BBC Two show, so we got a limited, you know, time to film that. And so we had Alan Armstrong and Paul Freeman.
Nice.
But, you know, then they surprise you then, because you think, oh, okay, I'd seen it slightly differently, but,
Well, that's the thing of having one vision in your mind, and then reality takes on a new form altogether, doesn't it?
Yeah, and of course you've got the actors, you've got the director, you've got the set, you know, you've got costumes, you've got that. So everything sort of comes in, and the music, which is obviously like important now. And so it was like you've got your words, and people like don't change them or anything, but you know, there's everything else going on top of it. So, you know, you are really you know, it is a sort of collective artistic, you know, experience. You know, the actors are the sort of, but then there's the editor as well. So, you know, if you're doing theatre, the audience are choosing who they're looking at.
Yeah,
you put it on telly, and the editor or the director, you know, is telling you what to look, telling you what to think.
Yeah,
you know, you've got somebody listening in the background. You know, they're directing you. They're directing your emotions and the music coming in. Whereas theatre, you've got to decide who you're going to look at, who you're going to be moved by.
Yeah, I mean, when you've done the first Gone to the Dogs, as a writer, I presume that you just hand the script over. Does your input stop there, or do you go on set?
Yeah, oh yeah, no. So well, especially now because I executive produce everything, so I'm there every day.
Brilliant.
For, you know, like, so all the questions tend to be coming to me, especially on something like Our Girl, because of course you need somebody that's done all 30 episodes. You know? Yeah. So they know you go, no, you can't do that because your brother was shot in Afghanistan.
yeah.
You know what I mean? Or whatever it is. You've got to know all the stories. But yeah, so, well, for a start, when you hand the script in, that's just the start of a process because then you're going through rewrites and, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, like lots of rewrites go on. And so, you know, people, the producer will give, you know, the good producers will give you, you know, short notes. It's almost like, you know, like a football manager will just say, you know, like that second half, you need to keep that energy up or
yeah.
something.
Yeah,
rather
yeah,
than
yeah.
all these specific, get on your left foot, tip it up the light. You know,
yeah.
And those one, you know, three line, you go, God, bloody hell, yeah, no, I can't, I'm getting snow blind. But yeah. if you just say, it's a bit soggy in the, you know, why don't you move that event that happens at the end, move it halfway through and then see what happens afterwards or whatever, you know. So you get good notes and not so good notes. But yeah, so you work on that script, you might do 10, 20, 30, you know, drafts, not always full drafts, but
no.
And then when it gets to the shooting script, you know, there still might be changes once you've, you know, once you're on set. But yeah, so you'll be on set and you've got the, you know, you've finished all the episodes. And so you'll be there. Sometimes you won't know what to do because everybody else has got a job on set. It's only the writer that ain't got, you know, he's finished his job or she, you know, and everybody else is running around with bloody cables. You
know, earning their keep,
yeah. I'll go, oh, yeah, my ideas, you know, like, and they don't care, you know, they just want to get on with it. And, but of course, you know, when it's working well, you'll sit there with the director and the exec and they'll go, what do you think of that scene? You go, yeah, like, you know, maybe we should cut that one line. Well, she's, like slightly struggling with it, but I wonder if it gets in the way. So yeah. Can you give us another line there though? So yeah, okay. You know, so you know, there is a sort of process that's still going on.
Yeah.
And then of course, when you get to the edit, you sit in the edit, and that's where you do your final draft. Which I've never realized. I've only just started to realize this. Having been in this game for decades, is that, you know, like, oh, okay, let's take out that. I was showing them the back of the head, add a new line. Because now so much is ADR, you know, where you do the additional dialogue record. But
yeah.
So it's the ADR. You go into the studio office. All the actors come back for ADR. And you're giving them other lines, you know, when there's shots on the back of the head, which the audience, of course, they never notice.
Of course.
And you're changing bits of the story. So you're doing a whole new draft sometimes.
Wow.
You know, and other people, you know, like I've not so much on my shows, but I've heard other shows where they've changed an entire scene. So it's always on the reaction of the other person, the occasional lip movements, but they've changed the whole essence of that scene.
And how are you watching it back? Do you see it as a program or a film, or is it when it's on screen, do you see the background, if you like?
Well, yeah, no, it's very hard to watch your own, because obviously you've been sitting in the edit, you've seen it 500 times.
Yeah.
But that first, there is something about when it comes on the telly and you're sitting there with the other, you know, 5-10 million people that watch it. And then suddenly you start to see it, as they say, and you go, oh, fucking hell. And you've got Twitter on the go, like, oh, fucking hell.
Getting a live feed.
Yeah, because people on Twitter obviously like to dig out pretty much everything,
of course,
and especially as it's going on. But so I said we've been fairly well treated, but yeah, you sometimes see those moments that you hadn't seen before, and I don't quite know why you only see them for the first time when it's going on. That's very strange.
And I can imagine there'd be something that seems fine when it's being filmed.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
Sometimes something may not work on screen, and I presume you're like, well, it was fine when we done it. You know, that little snafu moment. I don't know what happened.
I know. It's interesting. Well, that's why it's quite good to have an editor. So that obviously you have the editor and the director and then the execs go in to the edit. But the editor hasn't been on set. Or anything. So any of the jokes or funny...
So he's got fresh eyes. Really? I didn't realise that.
Yeah, so because they're going, well, that's just shit.
Yeah, brilliant.
And you're going, oh, it was so funny. When
but you had to be there.
Put a little line at the bottom. This was really funny. Alison actually fell over during this scene or whatever, you know. And so you get it together. But you see, you still definitely miss bits. And then you go, when it comes on, you go, yeah, and they got a point there. You know, that is a bit orcs, you know.
Another question that I do have for each guest is what piece of work that you've created has got the strongest emotional connection?
Well, of course, they all do have at the time. Otherwise, they're going to sink. Well, I don't know, because they all have different emotional connections, because what was going on in my life at that time, you know, so if I was watching Burst Marriage This Now, I would be reminded of a time when I'm watching Our Boy. It was like when my son had just been born. Not that I watched sitting indoors watching my stuff, but you know, like Our Boy reminds me of a time, you know, that you know, and I remember, you know, the whole, you know, working on it and working through it, and yeah, so I don't know. I don't know whether I have, I could say there's one that I feel. I mean, I think if you're talking to a painter, yeah, there would be a, you know, different answer. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's ones that I like most, so that gives me an emotional connection. You know, I like doing Burst Marriage and Death, and I like doing Bodily Harm. You know, I actually like doing The Martins, although the film was like a sort of hit and miss, I suppose, you know. Yeah. The one with Lee, but there's a lot of good things, and Kathy Burke, and I was able to work with Kathy, and we had a fantastic time.
Oh man, Ray Winston and Kathy Burke. Yeah. I know they've worked together a few times, but oh, superb.
Yeah, no, they're amazing.
We got mutual friend being Ray Richardson. How did you come by being pals with Ray?
Well, I just because I'd liked his work, and then. I got one of his paintings. So I went to the Art Expo, where it was in Angel somewhere.
Oh yeah, the London Art Fair.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, and there was a sort of limited. Oh, I was in the other room actually. This limited edition. I don't know whether it was a print or something with a dog in the basket, and he's pushing. It's called One Man Trolley or something like that.
Yeah.
And there was like 40. So I bought one of those. And then I saw he was on Instagram. And I said, and I made that connection. I told him about that I saw a painting of his once, another exhibition. This is like years ago, 25 more, yeah. 30 years ago. And it was like a fella in a West Ham shirt with the old hooped West Ham shirt frying eggs.
That's like, it. Yeah, another one.
Yeah. And it was called Hammer Blow, maybe.
Yeah.
And I said, I love that. And it was one. It was. I said to him, it was £1,700, and I just got married at the time. And my wife said, we need a new kitchen. So I said, yeah, but that's like, and it was exactly the same money, because she'd seen the kitchen for £1,700.
Oh, please tell me you bought the picture.
I got overruled. That's why we divorced, because I said, let it go.
I've always resented him for it.
For 25 years, I said. So, and then Ray said, "Well, I'll paint you another one if you want." So I said, "Okay, but I don't want to be prescriptive. You paint what you want."
Yeah.
You know, we've had a chat now, and that's what the one he painted that was in the you know, his studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see the picture?
I did.
As soon as
I walked in.
So I bought that off of him. He hasn't brought it around, so maybe he's just done a runner with the Dodge.
Yeah.
I know he's had a lot of holidays since I bought it.
Yeah.
Was that the one? Because he tagged us both in a painting the other
day. He did.
He reminded me, I hadn't replied to your message, actually, which was a fantastic one. I think that was like down at Canby as well, because I think my painting is set on Canby Island, isn't it? I think he goes down there for inspiration, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So then we just had a few chats on Insta, and then swapped numbers, and so I think that time I saw you down there with him was the first time I've actually met him. Yeah. Although we chatted on, you know.
Well, I think that anyone who comes from a working class background, not necessarily London, but anyone from a working class background, you would absolutely get Ray Richardson.
Yeah, no, he's great. Well, somebody once said Ray Richardson paints like you write.
Brilliant. So that's not bad at all, is it?
Yeah. So that was a nice thing to say. And so, yeah.
Like me being able, mentally being able to be an artist. Yeah, and as I say, I always put everything back down to Ray Richardson, just for that, seeing him on the telly and hearing his voice.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It just confirmed that, you know, a working class bloke from a council estate can be this thing, just like yourself being a being a writer. You know, most kids from a council estate wouldn't think that that would be.
Well, that's right.
You know what I mean?
And I suppose, you know, that's what, with things like Our Girl, it's like, it's not about go and be a medic in the army, for God's sake. It's not about, but it's about do the best. You can do anything. Yeah. Go and do it. Don't sit on your ass going, regretting it. Go and do it. And that's what you've done. I mean, it's an amazing story. I mean, because a lot of people go, oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind being a writer. I go, oh, what have you written? Well, I haven't written it. Well, that's all you got to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, get a notepad and just fill it up.
Yeah.
You know, type it out. We've all got computers or phones or tablets. You know, it's an easy thing now.
Yeah. Well, my mate Kimberly, she come from Dagenham. She was a year older than me at school, although not in my school. She was cabin of a night, and she was just writing during that and in her free time. I mean, fast forward sort of 20 years later, she's a Times bestseller now, you know?
Brilliant.
And especially nowadays as well, the working class thing in the creative environment, it's so important. Yeah. So important.
Yeah. Well, I think it always used to be, you know, ordinary people that became the artist. And then for about the last sort of 15, 20 years, you know, the poshos have taken over everything.
Yeah.
Acting, writing, directing, you know, and slowly I think people are going, no, we want a whole lot of different voices now. So whether you're, you know, diverse or disabled or, you know, like working class or whatever you are, then they want all those different stories. So there's a real push for diversity in all its forms, including working class now.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than having a working class story written by someone who's never been on a red bus for a council estate, isn't
it? Exactly, yeah.
If you wasn't a writer, Tony, what do you think you'd like to be?
Well, I've often thought about that, Gal, because I'm thinking, thank God I am a writer, because there's nothing else I can do. I presume I'd have found a niche somewhere doing something, you know, but I don't know what it could possibly be.
Has there never been anything you'd like to do? Or thought about?
I think I just so love being a writer and working in, you know, film, TV, theatre, that's all I've sort of wanted to do. You know, and I know a lot of other writers have political aspirations, and Russell D. Davis has got his thing going on, you know, like, and he's very political. But I don't feel very, we're all a little bit political, but I've got no aspirations in that area. You know, when I first left drama school, I did a bit of drama teaching, you know, which was great, but it was really just, I was doing youth theatre.
Yeah.
You know, I was ready to move on after a year or two. That felt like my national service, you know.
I absolutely love it when I speak to a creative and they can't think of anything else they could do or would want to do other than what they're doing.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that.
So it's maybe we all just fall into these things, don't we? You know?
Well, there isn't a question that I ask visual artists, which is, if there was you and five other artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be? But in your case, if you could have a writing team with any writers, past or present, who do you think you'd like on your team?
What to be writing together? God, that would be absolute murder. Because I hate the American idea of writers' room. I can't do that. I just sit here like one of them old Victorian photographers, a black shroud over my head,
okay.
And I just type away myself. The idea of working with, there's a lot of other writers that I've completely admired.
You know? Well, let's go down that route. That's easier.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, you can go back like, you know, Oscar Wilde, when he was like, the importance of being earnest and some other places, you go, that's sort of like absolutely amazing. You know, when Bleasdale wrote Boys from the Black Stuff, you know, like, I just think,
that was so different, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It changed TV for me.
Yeah. I mean, and Yoss's story, we're talking about performances earlier on, you know, Bernard Hill in that part was so incredible. I mean,
he was scary, wasn't he?
I think I think he talked about it. He got so into that part, it was very hard for him to step out, and he never really, you know, reached those goals again.
Yeah.
And it's funny when people reach those goals. I mean, Ray, to a certain extent, did with Scum, although he's had other little, you know, but that Scum. Phil Daniels with Quadrophenia. Yeah, yeah. And I know he came into EastEnders and has done bits and bobs, you know, including some stuff with me. But his part in that was amazing. It's the same with, you know, Bernard Hill, you know, because why didn't he go on to be the great actor of all time, you know, after that?
Maybe that's where Ray got his inspiration for the headbutt.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, who else, Tony? Sorry.
Well, yeah, so, and then, you know, like, we got a lot of good writers now, haven't we? You know, Sally Wainwright is doing great stuff. But if you go, like, going back into the past, I don't know, I'd love to sit in a room with loads of them and listen to them and, you know, ask where their ideas come from. I don't think anybody can ever give you, you know, my ideas come from, but you know, it's not like, you know, and you always get asked that question, where your ideas come from. So you can't go, well, you know, Sainsbury's superstore, in between the saucepans and the you've got ideas, you know, that's right. Because you just get them from just being around people, me talking to you, you know, you listen to your story, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I might nick a bit of that, you know, like it's, you know, like everything is sort of, it all comes in a mesh. And you know, when Oscar Wilde had gone down to Brighton to write The Importance of Being Earnest, to get out of London, where I think he was a part of the sort of like the gay scene and everything going on there. But then all the names of Worthing, you know, so he was getting inspiration from around him. And the bag was left at the train station at Victoria, you know, they've lost baggage department at Victoria. You know, so everything was like, you know, going on in his head. I don't know. I mean, I've never really gotten into Shakespeare, but I suppose it would be quite interesting to see, you know, to know what he's about, because I sometimes see Shakespeare plays and I think, oh, it's not for me, you know. But I mean, I don't know. I don't quite get it. It's like opera. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned about Oscar Wilde there. There's a little verse of his from Red in Jail. The vilest deeds, like poison weeds, bloom well in the prison air. 'Tis only what is good in a man that wastes and withers there. Yeah, quite a,
well, of course, quite he only a wrote line. Because he'd spent 2 years, he got 2 years hard labour in Reading Jail. That's why he was able to, like, touch something so brilliant and truthful. You know, that's the thing. If you're making up stuff, you know, where's the truth in it? Like, you talk about Ray's paintings and there's a truth in there, you know, and I suppose that's what you're saying when, you know, is it autobiographical or, you know, emotional connection? There's always got to be a truth in all the writing for all the characters, whether they're good or bad or, you know, evil or nuts. There's got to be a truth in them. And if you have a truth in the story and the characters and the dialogue and the setting, and there is a real core of truth, the audience will go, I get it.
It clings to them.
Yeah. And that's why it was really interesting that you like the Ballad of Reading Jail, because that's like, you know, an amazing piece of writing.
Yeah. And likewise, what you're saying there about, this is me personally, when I'm watching a programme or a film, if they're trying to sell you a scenario and you believe that what's on the screen absolutely wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
For me, that ruins on the whole program, you know.
Yeah, you don't believe it. You're suddenly,
it feels like you're being lied to. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not in safe hands because there's no truth in it. You know, that's why the kids like Harry Potter. They don't think they can get on their broomstick or whatever it was, you know, and fly off.
Yeah.
But they can in that world because they created that world. Yeah,
brilliant. And which is what a writer does, just creates a world for people to walk into. That's what I always say about Ray's paintings is, That Ray just builds his little world and you walk into it, you know. And when he invited me to sit for him, I mean, what a proud moment that was for me to be able to be literally a part of his world. Yeah, it was a huge honour.
Yeah, no, brilliant. And he does you really well, you know, like it's you blend together very well, I think.
I mean, you wouldn't have thought that you could make this any more handsome. But he does.
Because, like, you know, like you're talking about painters and you're talking about writers, but a painter starts with a story. And what story is he going to tell? And he's going to, okay, I'll do one about Canby Island and the old bicycles under the old rusting pier and that will, and people will be, and I'm the same with a blank piece of paper. You fill it up and you tell a story.
Well, when you listen to any creative's journey of that creation, it's pretty much all the same. Blank canvas, end product, and that route that you took to get there.
Yeah.
There's a podcast I listen to that's where they speak to comedians and the comedians dissect their joke and say how they created it. It's exactly the same process, even with a joke.
Well, because a joke is just a story, and a story is a script. Yeah. And then we hone it and hone it and hone it. And when the comedian goes on stage and he gets a big laugh, he goes, okay, I got that one right. Or if he gets a small laugh, he goes, I think I fucked that up. I shouldn't have added that, you know, and he fucking laughed, like, or whatever it is. And they, so they, you know, I've done too much. You know, so yeah. And it's the same because all of us are doing something for an audience.
Yeah.
You know, Ray's doing this thing so he can put it on the wall and people could walk by and go, yeah, that's all right. Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
what have you got coming up, Tony?
I'm working on a couple of new projects now. I'm working on my first theatre piece since I was at the Youth Theatre.
Nice.
So, which is nice. So I'm just developing that now. Hopefully that'll be for 2023. So
is it going to be a particular theatre at the moment?
No, because we're still developing it. And they won't, you know, like nobody knows which theatres are going to be, you know, available and all that stuff. But I'm working with House Productions and Francesca Moody Productions. And so and it's Tessa Rossi who runs House. So she was head of drama at the BBC and Channel 4, actually. So that's why I've done a lot of my projects with her. And she said, well, she's working on it. I told her this idea. And she said, okay, let's develop that. So we're now developing that. Tessa's formed her own independent company now. So it was like literally she was head of independence at BBC, head of drama and film 4 at Channel 4, where she was doing things like Slumdog Millionaire, 12 Years a Slave. So she's done lots of like great stuff. You know, gave Steve McQueen his first directing work, you know. So and now she's formed this company and and doing lots of great stuff there. So I'm back working with her, and then I've just started to develop something with 11 Films, who did Sex Education on Netflix.
Nice. Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm working with them. So yeah, just developing things. So it won't be for this year, but so hopefully the 23-24 season.
And how are you writing for theatre? Is it very different from writing for TV?
Yes, in one sense. You know, you still need that story. You know, you still need, you know, a beginning, middle and end. They don't have to come in the same order. You know, you can do them out of sequence. But, you know, you need to grip your audience. They need to be interested in those characters. They need to want to know what's going to happen. You know, and then you have your conclusion. So there are similarities, but huge differences as well.
Brilliant. So and how does it feel, the idea of going back into theatre?
Absolutely loving it. Absolutely loving it. I cannot wait. So, you know, if it, you know, touch wood, it all goes ahead and we're in that rehearsal room, I'm absolutely buzzing about that, you know.
Excellent.
And then we'll have all those creatives there because of the sound and the lighting and the director and, you know, the actors, and we're all going to go and make this thing, and then, you know, we'll stick it on and people will come in and watch 90 minutes of this. And, you know, obviously, you know, I'm dealing with millions and millions of people on TV and on theatre, you're, you know, dealing with 400 people a night, you know.
Yeah. Bearing in mind, I know nothing about this process. With a theatre production, and it all looks fine on paper, it all looks fine when you do your rehearsals. When it goes live, if there's something that isn't quite gelling with the audience, are you able to edit that, if you like? Or does it stay in there?
No, I think you definitely do rewrites. Preview. So before you officially open, you're doing these previews.
Yeah.
Well, I'd imagine that things are changing all the time. You know?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the actors are going, oh, yeah. Maybe, do you think that bit of business up there isn't working? I should go down, you know.
Yeah. And Tony, where can people find what you're doing, be it online or social media?
Well, I don't really, as you know, I don't really do it. I've got my, I've got an Instagram, tony.grounds, but I tend to like post when there's something going on, you know.
Yeah. So yeah. Social media, you have a presence.
Well, yeah. So when stuff goes on, and then sometimes the BBC, especially during Our Girl, you know, all, you know, like, well, I say the BBC, you know, like the producer would say, can you retweet this? And, you know, and I'm going, like, I think I've got like about 10,000 people following me. Why don't you get Michelle to do it? She's got 4 million.
Yeah. And she's pretty cool to work with, I'm sure.
She's absolutely lovely. You know, she's a real good team player and understands that, you know, we've got to get the work done. So
and did Our Girl reach a conclusion?
Yeah, so we concluded it at the end of series five. You know, there was talk, we were thinking about doing another series, but then COVID came and South Africa is quite hard to film in now, yeah. You know, because we were filming out there for 10 years. So,
brilliant.
And then everybody at the BBC was changing. We've got a new head of drama. So everybody left and my execs all left. So, yeah, it felt like a natural time, really.
So would there be a little bit of advice you could give to an aspiring writer, Tony, do you think?
Yeah, live your life and come up with a good idea.
Perfect.
You know, don't read all the books on it and go, oh, I've got to have an inciting incident after 9 pages. Don't worry about it. Come up with your idea first.
Yeah.
They'll tell you how to do it. Or if you've got a brilliant idea, other people will help you form it into the, you know,
brilliant.
The right shape.
All right, mate. Well, I'll leave you there. Thank you. I'm sorry to have fucking dragged it out.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you, Gar. I absolutely adore you, mate. I think you're absolutely fantastic. You know, if you're around and Ray's around and we'll go for a beer or something.
For definite.
Anytime, Gal, and I'd love to meet you again. So fantastic.
All right, mate. Thanks, Gal. Brilliant. Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. If you're unable to support us on Patreon, leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to this podcast really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast, or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Anything is appreciated, but either way, thanks for listening, and until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.